مرحبا لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Communique. As Yemen marks the 7th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led bombings, there's a silent killer in Yemen that no one is talking about, the blockade. The Saudi-led coalition has imposed a siege on Yemen, preventing fuel ships from docking in the port of Hodeidah. This has caused fuel prices to skyrocket. People can't afford cooking gas, electricity. The country's inflation has gone ballistic, and the poorest country on earth is being forced to pay hundreds of millions of dollars extra for fuel for absolutely no reason. Now, the Saudis claim that there is no embargo on Yemen. They say that Yemenis are free to import food and all sorts of commodities, but the part that they leave out is that they're not letting Yemenis import fuel. And when there are fuel shortages, the entire economy goes down the drain. Now, what I'm about to show you here is a presentation of my own independent investigative journalism in partnership with a Yemeni economist. He graduated from Oxford and worked at the World Bank. His name is Amir Al-Tiba, and he put together this report which shows the true extent of the Saudi embargo. This is the silent killer that no one is talking about, the silent killer that is destroying Yemen, and we're going to expose it right now. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. So before we go any further, as I said, this is an independent investigation which we released on our own. All of the data in this report, which was put together by Oxford economist Amir Al-Tiba, comes from places like the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, and other international organizations. This is on purpose to avoid anyone accusing the report or the data of being biased. And actually, that leads to the numbers being deflated. These are conservative estimates. Now, this information is, of course, very damning to Saudi Arabia, to the United States, to its allies and its backers, and people will try to discredit it. They'll try to attack its integrity. So in order to avoid just that, the data has been sourced from purely unbiased, objective international association. So just a brief recap of the situation. Yemen has been at war for 7 years, right? It's March 23rd, 2015, when Saudi Arabia begins its bombing campaign. And as a result, Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world. 17.4 million people. So the majority of Yemen's population are food insecure. According to UNICEF, 20 million of Yemenis live in extreme poverty. Yemen experienced one of the world's worst cholera epidemics in recent history, with over 2.5 million cases. All the bombings, the famine, the disease, the destruction have led the UN to describe the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Now, the majority of Yemenis live in areas that are controlled by the government in Sana'a. In the West, they often refer to this government as the Houthis or Ansar Allah. The Saudi coalition, on the other hand, support the government in Aden, which was deposed in a coup. Now, this is officially, it's the internationally recognized government, even though it lacks popular support. And that's who Saudi Arabia, that's who the UAE, that's who the United States have been backing. And it's in order to crush the Sana'a government, where, again, It's under their jurisdiction that most Yemenis live. This Saudi-led coalition have begun bombing Yemen. Britain and the United States have profited immensely from this genocide. They've sold Saudi Arabia literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons and provide them with training and logistical support. You know, just this January, the Saudis bombed a prison, killing 70 people. They even disabled the entire country's internet after destroying vital infrastructure in the port city of Hodeidah. Now this week, as we said, marks 7 years since the start of the bombing campaign. People gathered in Yemen to mark a national day of resistance and show their resolve, show their resilience in the face of all this adversity. And right now, you know, what people are talking about is the fact that Yemen hit a petroleum storage facility in Saudi Arabia belonging to Aramco. This happened as the Formula One Grand Prix is taking place. And of course, while the photographs and the videos from that certainly make for interesting headlines and front pages, there is a much bigger story about Yemen that doesn't receive anywhere near as much attention. So let's say you're a fuel tanker, right? And you want to bring gasoline or you want to bring diesel to Yemen to sell it. Well, what do you do? First, you need to obtain permission from the United Nations Verification and Inspection Mechanism for Yemen, UNVIM. So this was set up to inspect vessels and their cargo. Ships headed to Yemen, they got to stop first in Djibouti. And once they pass inspection, they're issued a clearance certificate. Now, the issue is that right before they get to Hodeidah, to the port city of Hodeidah in Yemen, the Saudi Navy start detaining these ships, despite the fact that they already have clearance from the UN, right? So once they get close to Yemen, the Saudi Navy stops them and they take them to the so-called coalition holding area in the Red Sea. Now, obviously, randomly detaining ships voids the entire purpose of the UN verification. And not only that, but by detaining these fuel ships, the price of fuel goes up. Because if you fail to offload a ship's cargo, that prevents the owner of the ship from using the vessel to do other business, right? So they start losing money. And then you have to pay the owner of the chartered ship a fine. This is also known as a demurrage cost. And so in 2020, the total amount of demurrage fines because of the Saudis detaining fuel ships on the way to Yemen was $85 million. The next year in 2021, it was $24.5 million. Now, at first sight, you might be thinking, well, that's an improvement, right? $24.5 million is a lot less than $85 million. But no, you'd be wrong. It's not an improvement. As a matter of fact, the situation got worse. In 2020, a gasoline or diesel ship would be delayed for around 61 days on average. In 2021, a ship could be expected to be detained for 85 days. So the annual average demurrage costs for just one vessel went up from $1.14 million to $1.65 million. That's a 44% increase from 2020 to 2021 on average for every ship. And who pays for this in the end? Yemenis. Yemenis, of course, at the market, at the pump. And so the only reason that the total dollar amount of demurrage fines went down from 2020 to 2021 is ironically because less ships started coming into Yemen, right? People became reluctant to even attempt bringing fuel there because it's just so difficult. So many vessels that were originally planning to go to Yemen ended up going back or docking instead in neighboring countries and selling their cargo there. And so you can see from this table how year by year, the costs get higher and higher. In 2019, the annual average demurrage costs per one ton of gasoline is around $16. Then $49 in 2020, then $165 in 2021. So in 2019, you know, a gasoline ship would be held for 23 days on average. And then in 2021, 219 days. I mean, think about that. That's almost an entire year that a fuel ship is not allowed to move, not allowed to offload its cargo. And in some cases, there are indeed ships that have been held over a year. 219 days is just the average. And so once the ships actually reach Yemen, it gets worse. Because with this blockade, they can't go to Hodeidah port, right? So instead, they have to go offload their cargo either in Adan or in Mukalla. So in ports that are under control of the Saudi-backed government. Now, not only are these ports further away from Hodeidah, but they also slap the fuel ships with higher costs. The customs fees, commissions to the refineries, security fees, intermediary office fees, higher transport costs, transport damages. All of this adds up like you would not believe. And so if you look at the table, you see that in November 2021, this adds up to $410 extra for every ton of gasoline and $317 extra for every ton of diesel. Okay? So that's we're talking $410 for every ton of gasoline, $317 for every ton of diesel extra than if they had just gone to Hodeidah. So again, just look at this detour, because once the fuel trucks get going from Hodeidah to Sana'a, it's just 226 kilometers distance. Or let's say Aden to Hodeidah, which is usually a 430 kilometer drive. But now, the fuel trucks have to take this enormous detour. So this obviously increases the cost of transportation so much, because the trucks have to travel a further distance, increase their fuel consumption, and other incurred fees and potential breakage costs. So again, just to recap, the fuel ships come to ports controlled by the Saudi-backed government. They have to pay higher taxes, then higher transportation costs because the journey is longer. And on top of that, you have the roadblocks. So all along this yellow route, you have various militias, various armed groups, including Al-Qaeda, that set up checkpoints. And so when the fuel trucks try to pass, they shake them down for money, right? If the drivers don't pay up, they get killed. And so other militias that are also affiliated with the Southern Transitional Council are involved. You know, one checkpoint will add 5% to the pump price, another 10% here, another 5% there. And so you've got about 50 checkpoints with groups that are looking to make a quick buck. And who pays for this? Again, it's the Yemeni civilians who have to pay the cost, the incurred cost at the pump. So because of all these obstacles, because of this embargo, you know, people are discouraged to bring fuel ships at all to Yemen. So in 2020, you had a total of 73 ships that brought fuel to Hodeidah. The following year, 5 ships. 5 fuel ships came to Hodeidah in 2021. That is a 60% decrease. Do you know how many fuel ships have come so far to Hodeidah this year in 2022? One. Literally just one. So not only is the fuel in Yemen more expensive, but it's not even enough. It doesn't suffice. And so when it comes to oil derivatives, there was a deficit of 49% in local consumption. Okay? So what does that mean? That means that Yemenis only consumed half the oil that they actually need in all of 2020. Okay? So in 2020, Yemen needed 1.3 million metric tons of gasoline. They only got half. A 49% deficit in gasoline and diesel. In 2021, a 90% deficit, 90. So even if Yemenis could afford the oil, there's not enough coming in. And so like all countries that are impacted by sanctions, this embargo has led to the creation of a black market. And while the official prices for oil are low, well, there simply isn't any oil to sell. That means that consumers have to turn to the black market, where price gouging is rampant. People are forced to pay several times over what they normally would out of pure necessity. So just to give you an idea how bad this is, during the first 5 months of 2021, the price of oil on the black market went up 90% each month on average. So again, look at this graph. You can see the monthly average of gasoline prices in Sana'a per liter per riyal. And you can see the monthly average of diesel prices as well. And so in the first 5 months of 2021, the price on the black market, which is in red, it just climbs and climbs and climbs and keeps climbing. Now you can imagine what this increase, this steep increase in fuel prices ends up doing to the people in Yemen, to Yemen's agriculture, Yemen's industry, Yemen's service sectors. This also means that you end up with oil derivatives that are of poorer quality because they're not controlled by the authorities. So they not only cost more, but they're also damaging the environment. They're damaging the consumers. They're damaging property and equipment. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Amir Al-Tibah is the Yemeni economist who compiled all of this data, who did this brilliant job. He helped me put together this report. Amir studied in the United Kingdom. He's an Oxford graduate, and he used to work at the World Bank. He's been a country economist for almost 30 years now. He's based in Sana'a, and we spoke earlier about this report and the effects of the siege in more detail. Amir, thank you for coming on the program and taking the time to sit down and go through this with me. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure and honor to speak to you.
Amir, let's start from the beginning. Let's explain the chain of events. Basically, there are ships that are carrying fuel coming to Yemen, but they don't actually come straight to Yemen. They get stopped first. Why do they get stopped?
First, we will have to say, this is commercial imports are done by the private sector. So the public sector here, the government, have no foreign reserves or hard currencies, and they cannot finance the import bill. So everything has to be done through the private sector. And then in order to qualify or to be able to submit or to purchase a fuel vessel, you have to first pay for the 100% in advance for the cost of the shipment. Once the importer overcomes these restrictions, the fuel be purchased from the UAE. This is the facts that kept from the public. Once the fuel departs from UAE and heads to Yemen, to Hodeidah port, it gets redirected to Djibouti port, where the fuel has to be inspected and verified by the UN verification inspection mechanism. This is a new body, a UN body, which was created as a result of the Security Council resolutions. And there, the fuel and the entire the paperwork for the vessel and the content of the vessel will be inspected. And after that, once the fuel is inspected and cleared by the UN, the fuel would leave the port of the vessel would leave the port of Djibouti, heading towards Hodeidah. And there, the vessel will be stopped and detained by warships of the coalition, and then taken to attention area near Jazan port in Saudi Arabia. There, there is always an excuse or a justification for why ships are detained. Each day would cost, would add $20,000 worth of delay or demurrage fees onto the final cost of the fuel. Some of them are permitted to enter Hodeidah eventually, but then only when the total cost of the fuel is much, much more than the real cost of, that day. This had huge consequences on the prices. I mean, we've had a severe fuel shortages and very flourishing black markets for smuggled fuel throughout, during the conflict since 2015. But last year, the problem became much, much worse. To put it in figures, last year, only five ships were allowed to enter Hodeidah eventually throughout. Five fuel vessels of diesel and gasoline.
So basically, you end up with a situation where the necessary fuel consumption for the whole year, only a tiny fraction is actually coming through Hodeidah, but the majority is coming through the land ports, right? And who controls the land ports?
This was not very common before 2021, but since 2021, suddenly, because vessels would not be allowed to enter through Hodeidah, and then this would eventually create so much resentments and frustration by the public, in addition to the suffering and shutdowns and suspensions by several sectors in the economy. So eventually, I think starting from April last year, the authorities here started to regulate and allow fuel supply from Aden and from other ports controlled by the government in Aden. eventually, this, you know, the additional cost added onto this fuel was not big, but it, you know, it just gradually increased and became bigger and bigger until now, you know, the added cost amounts to almost 60% more than the cost of fuel imported through Hodeidah.
Right.
So this is an additional inflationary effect, which has an impact on everything. But also because of, you know, the inflated cost of transport and because of this roadblocks, where you know each fuel tanker will have to be stopped and pay and will have to pay informal levies to mostly armed militia groups. Some are affiliated with the government in Aden, some are not. And this is not, I mean, this is not really shocking or surprising or a new phenomenon. I mean, we've seen this in South Sudan, we've seen it in so many different countries. It's really, it's financing and providing finances to armed groups, which will definitely prolong the conflict and fuel violence throughout Yemen. So
does that include Al-Qaeda as well?
Absolutely. I mean, this is not. I mean, this has been recognized and publicized by activists in the north and the south.
In the report, we saw that in 2021, the direct financial losses because of this increase in oil prices and oil derivatives, you know, gasoline and diesel, was $644.4 million. So, I mean, just to get this straight, does that mean that people in Yemen in 2021 they paid an extra $644 million, or because of this increase in oil prices and the lack of oil, it caused the infrastructure and the state and businesses to lose money? Just to be clear,
this is how much the population, not the entire population, even. I mean, this is how much the population under the in areas and markets controlled by the Sana market, we're talking about 25 million, between 23 to 25 million people paid, you know, as an addition on their fuel prices. So this is not counting the damage estimates or financial losses, indirect or indirect, suffered by the economy or the infrastructure. This is how much the citizens of the poorest people in the world had to pay extra to get their fuel in 2021.
I wanted to talk to you about the difference in prices. We can see how in Riyal, the price of oil and oil derivatives is completely wild. We have a Su'al Aswad, which is the black market. We have Tijara, which is the private sector in this case, and then the Rasmi, which is the official price. My understanding was that the official price, it stayed low for as long as it could, but there's no oil. And then in the black market, there is oil, but the price skyrockets, of course, and then you have a lot of people making money off of that, right?
Yes. So the official price, this is for fuel imported through Hodeidah. And this is the most affordable and source for fuel, even before the current, restrictions. The commercial fuel, or the commercial price, is for fuel which is sourced from the port of Aden or Mukalla. So this is supplied by land, but imported by the private sector through the port of Aden or other ports controlled by the government in Aden. And just to add another fact, now the blockade and this inspection and verification mechanism for Hodeidah port, this is only applicable for Hodeidah port. But if you are importing fuel or any commodities through other Aden controlled ports, there is no such a thing. So we don't have to go through this very long and costly process. You don't have to be detained. You don't have to pay extra money for delay. And the irony of this is that most of the smuggling, including smuggled fuel, comes from those territories that are not under any supervision. And this is just another aspect of this politicized blockade.
This siege has resulted in a decline in purchasing power of Yemeni households, who are now left unable to cover their basic necessities even more than before, from electricity to cooking gas. in Yemen, there are 0 hours of electricity. Well, most people have to get our solar panels or private grids, and the cost is astronomical. That cost is directly linked to the cost of fuel in the black market. In a statement, the Federation of Yemeni Private Hospitals said that, quote, blocking fuel from entering Yemen has caused the death of many patients in intensive care units, emergency and operations departments, as well as the hospital's inability to save and store medicines for chronic diseases. Now, every year a donor conference is held and all these countries get together. This year, they actually couldn't even meet the goal that they had pledged to help Yemen. You know, they keep throwing money at the problem, but this doesn't fix anything. The inflation in Yemen has skyrocketed to not 1%, not 10%, 40% in 2021. Agriculture, industry, service sector, everything has been disrupted. Everything is more expensive as a direct result. And the Saudi-backed government appears to have a vested interest in blocking fuel shipments to Hodeidah. It gets to tax the population, and then on the flip side, provide Yemenis with nothing, right? They claim to be the legitimate government of Yemen, and they're in charge of all the reserves, the crude, the central bank, and yet they pay no public salaries. You know, they move the central back to Aden, but pay no salaries to public employees and servants. They pay no public salaries, but want to tax the population nonetheless. Now, there's no question, the bombings in Yemen need to stop immediately. And the aid is good, but it won't solve the crisis. What Yemen needs is for the siege to be lifted. This siege is man-made, it's completely unnecessary, and killing Yemenis on an unimaginable scale. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on RIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Here at The Key and IRIB English Radio, we would like to offer our congratulations to our esteemed listeners because, as you know, we have entered the month of Ramadan. Many Muslim countries, we've entered the month of Ramadan. And this month of Ramadan is the month of prayer. It's the month of dua. And today we're going to ask a question which is related to dua and prayer. And this is especially so important for Muslims who are living in non-Muslim countries. You know, people who are living in non-Muslim countries, Muslims living in non-Muslim countries, you know, they get asked this question a lot that by non-Muslims. Can you pray for me? This is the month of Ramadan. You know, your coworker might come up to you. Hey, I heard it's Ramadan. Can you pray for me in Ramadan? Or, you know, your friend at school, he might say, oh, I heard it's Ramadan. Hey, don't forget me in your prayers. You know, what do we say to such a person? Hey, I can't pray for you, you know, dude, you're non-Muslim or whatever. Can we pray for these people or not? According to a lot of the verses of the Holy Quran, if we look at these verses at face value, it seems as if these verses are saying that, no, it's not permissible for us to pray for non-Muslims, such as the following verse of the Holy Quran. You know, in this verse, God Almighty says that He tells the prophet, if you pray for them or don't pray for them, it doesn't matter. Even if you pray for them 70 times, right? God will never forgive them because they are disbelievers in God and the Holy Prophet, and God does not guide a transgressing lot. So verses such as this and similar verses seem to indicate the fact that it's not permissible for us to ask forgiveness and pray for non-Muslim. First of all, we should remember one point, and that's that in these verses, right, God Almighty is specifically talking about asking forgiveness for these disbelievers. He's not talking about praying, right, for other things, right? Like, for example, praying for their well-being, praying for their safety, and things like that, right? So this is the first point. So this verse is specifically restricted to asking for their forgiveness. And another point which is important to mention is that in other verses of the Quran, we see that this prohibition is restricted and conditioned with the fact that we should be sure that these people are going to go to hell. Right? So if there's a chance that they might be, forgiven and, you know, might be guided to the straight path, we should be able to pray for them, even for their forgiveness. For example, in a famous tradition in a riwayat, which has been narrated from Imam Kazim, the Imam says, there's no problem in you praying for a Christian doctor, right? There's no problem in it. Your prayer, then in the continuation, the Imam says, your prayer for him has no value, right? If or when God, your prayer for him has no value for him, you know, and God will not answer it. So in we can gather from this tradition that the Imam is trying to say that you can pray for them when, or this like this Christian doctor, unless you are sure that the prayer will not be answered and has no benefit from him. Meaning, in the case where you're sure that, you know, this person is, there's no, you know, possibility of his being guided. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the permissibility of praying for non-Muslims according to the Quran and the Hadith. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the Biden administration, too many unjust anti-immigrant policies remain, and thousands of immigrants are paying the price. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Rebecca Talbot and Panguit Tesoklas, writers. This article is published under the heading, ICE Continues to Abuse and Traumatize Under Biden. Here's the story. Just after dawn of September 16, 2021, EE and six other African immigrant men were resting in their bunks at the Glades County Detention Center in Moorhaven, Florida, when Captain John Gatson and a group of at least 15 sheriff's deputies stormed in, as reporters said, pepper spraying them in the eyes before dragging them to solitary confinement cells. EE and others sat in solitary with pepper spray burning their skin, prohibited from showering until the next day. On September 17th, EE received paperwork with charges, but someone else's name was on it. 9 days later, he and others finally had a hearing. They learned Glades would keep them in solitary for 30 days, the maximum time allowed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement Policy under the Department of Homeland Security. "We are being targeted," wrote EE in a formal complaint to the DHS Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. Conditions in DHS immigration prisons have been under scrutiny the entire 20 years of ICE's existence, just as the agency's predecessors has also experienced critics arguably all the way back to Ellis Island in 1890s, but their major differences are on their ICE, namely the massive scale of detention both in the number of people and the amount of time they are held. This has resulted in a major upsurge in national and international interest and outrage over the immigration policies that have become a defining characteristic of the United States, right alongside its unmatched behemoth of a prison system. Groups that may have previously focused on reforms and piecemeal improvements via legislation and litigation are joining in the call for a complete shutdown of ICE detention centers. Nonpartisan groups like ACLU have joined much smaller and often grassroots volunteer-led organizations, issuing powerful statements such as this one from September 2021 by ACLU campaign strategist Isra Checker that said, in the Biden administration, too many unjust anti-immigration policies remain, and thousands of immigrants are paying the price. Checker noted that until 1980s, most immigrants were not detained while navigating the legal process, but today, detention has become the norm rather than the exception. The reason has become painfully obvious to most anyone who takes a look, including the Government Accounting Office, GAO, which issued a report on ICE detention in February 2021. The report notes that of the $3.14 billion provided to operate its immigrant prisons, hundreds of millions in public dollars are wasted on empty beds, often being paid for under the terms of private contracts. These profiteering interests operate over 70% of ICE facilities, and they lobby hard to keep them open. Citing a similar profit motive in March 2021, Representative Ilhan Omar led a letter to President Biden's Director of Domestic Policy Susan Rice and Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas calling for an end to ICE contracts with local jails and prisons, saying, some of the worst examples of abuse and retaliation against detained immigrants during the COVID-19 pandemic occurred in jails and prisons operated by localities. In 2018, the Vera Institute's In Our Backyard series, which took a close look at the financing of jails and prisons around the United States, did a deep dive into the history of one such local facility contracting with ICE in Glades County, Florida. The history and present-day happenings at Glades reflect a much bigger picture of abuse and corruption at all levels, but also of the resistance that is bringing urgent changes to the immigrant detention policies for this country.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Youth Station again, where inshallah we shall make you feel young if you're not. If you are young, good. All right, with me is my dear sister, Asma. Assalamu alaikum, Asma, how are you?
Wa alaikum assalam, thank you for having me.
And you're smiling already, so I can tell that you are young at heart, at least.
Yes.
Okay, so sister Asma, now today let's discuss expectation of youth, especially in terms of religious media. And what attracts them. Now,
yes.
I don't know.
Which is very challenging.
is first, I don't know, I would like to ask you this question. Is even religion represented by the media?
Yes, sometimes there have been done some very beautiful movies that talk about religion, and there are some very intellectual peoples who are having some very fruitful pages on media everywhere. You could find them, you could, and as you follow them, you could just learn some interesting information about your religion, which maybe until then you have never considered or you have never thought about.
Okay, so you're saying that there is a presence of religion in media,
yes,
right?
There is, I mean, is it
attractive? Like you said, movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, movies, right?
Yes.
Is movies attractive to the youth these days, like religious movies?
If you don't look at them in a biased way, or through a glass that you put on your eyes, which says, oh, this is religion, so this is going to be boring.
No. Okay, not in terms of thinking. In terms of, let's say, okay, so if I want to compare a religious movie,
mm-hmm.
or you think of any movie you like, right? If I want to compare it with, let's say, any of the movies of Hollywood, right?
Yes, For example, Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, the Avengers, and all these things.
Yeah.
I mean, do they even compete? Like, I mean, look.
To be honest, yeah. There's no way for them to compete, but there has been some good jobs.
No. Okay, I disagree with you here.
Mm-hmm.
They can compete if they want. They're just not competing.
No, I mean...
Okay, what drives the youth towards the Western media, mm-hmm. especially like, you know, you use the example of movies. What drives us towards movies from mm-hmm. Hollywood rather than this religious movies? If you're talking about epic stories, we have epic stories, right?
Yes.
In religion.
Yes, we have.
But the way the media, the religious media, projects them is extremely boring.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they can't they can compete. They just don't. Okay?
No, so, I said until now, whatever that has been done, if we want to just make a comparison, they could not compete. Until now. Maybe this is, because for every good thing, for every perfect thing, you have to go through a lot of hard work. I think still we have not done that much of hard work.
Yeah, so they don't want to compete. For example, Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
if they want to make a movie,
yes.
it takes some years to produce. It's not a day or two.
No, years. It
takes
years,
some years,
and they have a group
millions
of writers,
of dollars, right?
So this the scenario
dollars
is
spent
buried.
On it. Yes. Now, do our religious foundation have that capacity or not?
Unfortunately, I would say no.
Well, I say yes. So the idea is people will give money,
mm-hmm.
even if in terms of, like, let's say, if I submit with you that the religious foundation do not have the funds, they can at least raise it from the people.
Well, I would say they don't have money as much as Hollywood pays for the movies or documentaries.
But Hollywood itself is not just movie making.
Mm-hmm.
It's money generating.
Let's go for a little break and then we'll be back. Thank you for listening to us and giving your ears and attention.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So the funds are there. People can collect the fund,
mm-hmm.
and people will give. And what they did is they put this movie in cinemas, which people go watch,
mm-hmm.
and they will get revenue back.
Yes.
And such revenue...
That would be a circulation.
...that would create for other movies. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I think that we can compete. We do have the funds in a way or another. We can get... best actors out there, best directors or movie makers
mm-hmm.
out there, we can get them to make. For example, if you make the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam into a series or into a movie, the actual Ali alayhi salam, that would be like humongous.
Yes, of course.
If you make the events of Karbala into a Hollywood movie.
I have always said that. We have the best tragic stories.
But no one cares. So
no
this
one
is exactly
cares.
What I'm saying. Is the media attracting the youth, the religious media?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're not attracting because they're not putting the effort. If they want to make a movie, they make what we call a corny, cheesy movie. Mm-hmm. Please.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
You know, and even in media, when I search about Islam, all that I see is some very boring discussions, and perhaps a very old person comes and gives lectures. And as a youth, that does not attract me.
Exactly.
I don't like to hear advices.
We want to hear advices, but just the way the advice is being produced.
Or yes, you know what I mean? Let me just rephrase what I said.
Yeah, so it's like, even with me, the same thing when I see a guy just sitting there and he's just like mumbling mm-hmm. things. I'm like, yes. Thanks, skip.
You know, I would feel sleepy more than I would be attracted to them.
See, now I've seen this trend happening. We have sheikhs who are mu'ammam, mm-hmm. but like, in some of the clips, especially on Instagram, like people would know that they are sheikhs, like they are mm-hmm. clerics. But then they would take off the turban, they wouldn't put on their suits and stuff like that. And they would do things that the youth would do. He even would go car racing, he would go do car burnouts.
That would be very nice. They would listen to him
and
more
and every,
more.
Like, and he has like hundreds of thousands of youth following him mm-hmm. because he was able to get in touch with them on things they like. Yes. So when he gives them an Islamic advice...
You should talk to them through their own language.
So when he gives them an Islamic advice, they perceive it much more from him than any other person.
Exactly.
Okay, who would give them the exact same words. Mm-hmm. But because he was able to take himself into down-to-earth state mm-hmm. and like do the things people do to go out restaurants. But, you know, that's what the youth like. They like this kind of... Mm-hmm. Because... Sadly, whether we like it or not, we live in this era. Well, we have to get in touch with
them. Well, we have to admit it. Believe it or not, nowadays, since we're living in a world where media talks, we have to do it in a way that attracts the majority of the youth. Because they are the ones that are the audience. They are the ones that are going to build the future.
It is their world.
We have to put money, effort, knowledge, whatever we have in order to attract them. If we want to make something out of whatever we think we have as a heritage.
And I think one of the saddest things that I also see for those who try to put themselves in front of the media and they try to bring themselves to a youth's kind of a corner, mm-hmm. they get labeled and they get spoken about badly by the religious media itself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like they say, oh, look at this guy. Look what he's doing. I'm like, well, that's the only way he could communicate with people. And instead of supporting him, you're talking badly about him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I'm kind of involved in this, I see a lot of people, when they do something, okay, maybe from where I stand, he shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But for where the youth stand, that's what they want to see. You know what I mean?
Yes,
so I can't just try to make everything like, it has to be like, 100% strict. Like, how could he drive a car how could he buy a sports car, first of all? Well, this is what kids like. Like I said, if I want to think of it, technically speaking, mm-hmm. everything direct to the point, maybe there are things shouldn't be done. But then again, I mean, I have to be more lenient. You know how Imam Ali says, "La takun layinan fatuksar," don't be too hard that you can break. "Wala layinan fatuksar," don't be too soft that you can get squeezed. Mm-hmm. You have to be flexible.
Flexibility.
I think the religious media today is like one-sided. It's like very straightforward. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no leniency in it. I can see like on Instagram and other pages, in order for them to play a Quran verse, they have to put so much things in the background.
Yes.
Or to attract you.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yes,
so
I know.
No longer the words are being effective. It's the media behind it mm-hmm. that makes you watch. You know what I mean? So I think we have a problem here.
Yes, a very big problem. You know, when I was younger, at the age of 14 perhaps, I was not so much interested in studying so much of those heavy books that were related to religion. Mm. But then at that time in TV, there was a man who was very innovative. And he told the stories from the Holy Quran in a very beautiful way. In a way that you can, I couldn't even imagine that one day I would sit in front of TV and count for the minutes for him to start telling those stories. Mm. But he said those stories in a very beautiful way, in a way that he attracted all the kids who were of my age. Mm. So the way you speak to the youth, the way you are going to represent, the way you are going to present Islam to people counts too much. because this is going to be the basic, the base for their learning, the base for their going through Islam. So that's very important. As I said, we have to invest a lot of money, a lot of effort. And still, I think we have done perhaps very little, very little.
Yeah, so the expectation of youth in this regard is very low.
Very low.
Would you agree?
Yes, of course. Yeah. I told you at the very beginning. Yeah. I think compared to other people who are working so strong, we have done
I don't know
very
if I should say this
work.
As well. I mean, at least our school of thought is not doing very well. Because when I look at other schools of thought,
yes.
they're putting a lot of money mm-hmm. into the media.
They have a plan, you know. What I see is a plan. But we don't, perhaps we, I don't know if it's true or not. But what I see as a young girl, I would say they don't have a plan.
To give a credit, there are, I mean, obviously we have to give a credit where credit is due. There are others who are working. But I mean, like, they're like very, like so small that you can hardly notice them.
So they are doing it like a turtle because that does not seem.
Exactly. But on a bigger scale, we're not doing. When I go on YouTube and I search Battles of the Prophet, for example, or Stories of the Prophets, most of it is made by other schools of thought. And obviously the problem with that is that they bring their own theology in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, which is devastating. For example, when I look at the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, and I watch a cartoon of that, and I, you know, they tell me that the Prophet got scared from Jibreel and he ran and he always wanted to commit suicide and throw himself out of the mountain. And I show that to a child. That's deadly.
Of course.
In terms of theology. You know what
yes.
I mean?
Yes.
So all this work is being done by other schools of thought. They put the effort, they put the money, they produce so much work.
Yes.
For the I mean, they even have a Muslim TV show.
Yes.
Like 24 hours. And it has like the best beautiful cartoons in terms of Islamic. They made like some Islamic villains in the history of Islam. They were villains to the... You can't imagine. They were bloodbaths. Right?
I would say other schools have been supported with so much of
money. No, but I'm saying these villains who are in Islamic mm-hmm. history, because other schools of thought, they look at them as heroes. They made series about them. They made
yes,
TV shows. They
yes,
made movies about
yes.
them. And the youth... are, you know, very, very in tune with it because it's very attractive.
Exactly.
For them. Where we, sadly, in our school of thought, we haven't put the effort. When we have, like you said, we have the best stories of everything.
Yes, the best stories. We could make great stories and great scenarios out of them, but we're not doing it.
Sadly.
Perhaps we have to work on that more and more. So we were talking about the expectations of youth from media and how to work on that point, which we gave you plenty much of ideas. Every single youth is responsible. So
I think it's not. I think maybe it's time for the youth themselves to take control.
Exactly.
Take
it's time for
I mean,
them
you know what you like,
to take the
you
initiative.
You know what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Put the effort. Don't wait for people. You guys, the youth should. I always say this. It's the duty of the youth.
This was Youth Station, and from me and the entire cast of Youth Station, I bid you farewell until another session. I leave you to the protection of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kHz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.